Yeah, 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 come and take a look at the snow. Bright white as far as your eyesight goes. Come and take a look at the fields of snow. I'll just get my coat, then we're good to go. Come and take a look at the lake. Let's have a quick skate before it gets late. Come and take a look at the frozen lake. Put your clothes on, mate, don't make that mistake.
Greetings, holiday shoppers. There are now 50 shopping days left until Christmas Day. And I think you know what that means. That means it's time for another episode of Christmas Creeps, your one-stop shop for holiday movies and TV shows all year round. Hi, my name is Joseph Wade. I will be your host for this evening. Here with me tonight, as always, is my co-host, Johnny Five, the human robot. John, what's got... I've already fucked it up, but John, what are you going on with today?
Watching Blizzard just make asses of themselves in public. That's mainly what I've been doing.
That sounds like a fun weekend. Like, they've been doing that for like three straight weeks too.
Yeah. Oh, they're doing it in person this time.
Oh yeah, definitely. Mr. Bradford has departed from this podcast for an indeterminate amount of time. We can tell you he and his wife did have a baby very recently, and everybody's doing great. But we have heard the last of Mr. Bradford for a while. However,
we kicked him off for liking anime too much.
Yeah, that's really what it comes down to. Mr. Weeaboo himself is gone. But in his stead, we do have a special guest here with us tonight to discuss tonight's film. Dr. Nick, our own friend of the podcast and horror expert, is here. Dr. Nick, what is shaking?
I'm going to podcast with you.
That's true,
It's a joke based on the movie.
Oh, I am not in the... I'm not in the headspace for that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Now, I wanted to do the whole bit, but I don't think I could do the entire... all the voices that happen in this movie with the phone calls. But yeah, I'm here tonight, bringing me in as, I guess, a horror nerd ringer. I have my cat in the room. My cat is named Jonesy after Alien, so that's my horror movie nerd credentials.
That's good enough for us. So tonight on the show, we are here to talk about one last holiday horror film because we kind of got a late start on Home for the Horror Days. So this week on the show, we're discussing 1974's Black Christmas from one Mr. Bob Clark, who has a very unusual filmography. A lot of people know him from A Christmas Story and maybe Porky's. However, he kind of sort of made a name for himself with Black Christmas. Now, Dr. Nick, tell us a little bit about that.
I'm surprised you want me to talk about Black Christmas and not his final couple movies where he directed Baby Geniuses and Baby Geniuses 2 Super Babies. But okay, I see how it is.
Dear God, I would have been less surprised if you said the Zapruder film.
No, yeah, and I think his last movie was a movie called Karate Dog, which features the voice of Chevy Chase as the titular Karate
Dog. Does Karate Dog take place at Christmas?
I have no idea.
Is that the one where the CGI Karate Dog does Kung Fu with John Voight?
Oh, John Voight's in it too?
Is that the one I'm thinking of?
Oh, it might be. Oh my gosh. It sounds like J5, though, wants an excuse to watch Karate Dog starring Chevy Chase as the voice of the dog, the Karate Dog.
Yes, confirmed. Karate Dog Chevy Chase does Kung Fu with John Voight.
At Christmas?
I'm so sorry.
Jamie Presley and Pat Morita.
Oh, Mr. Miyagi, no.
This is like the sequel to Four Christmases, or a prequel, maybe. This is why they got divorced.
Well, fortunately, this was not Pat Morita's last film. That would have been a very tragic ending.
Oh, wait a minute. Incoming news that I did not know about until just now. I checked Bob Clark's IMDb page. Apparently, he is uncredited as a co-director on the 2007 film Blonde and Blonder, making that his final film.
What the hell is Blonde and Blonder? Is that... I mean, that's got to be like somebody dumped Dumb and Dumber and Legally Blonde into a blender and then just dumped the remains on the floor, right?
Comic mayhem ensues when two lovely blondes, Dee and Dawn, are mistaken as international mob killers, and the two blondes are, of course, Pamela Anderson and Denise Richards. The tagline, according to the poster, is, "It's a no-brainer."
And this was 2007.
Yeah, look at the poster where just, like, there's only, like, a front of a car photoshopped into golf green, and Pamela Anderson and Denise Richards have horribly photoshopped heads.
Oh, jeez. Oh, this is horrifying. This is, like, scarier than anything in Black Christmas.
Yeah, I'm getting close there.
I mean, it's, yeah, it's Claire with her head wrapped in a plastic bag, and then Blonde and Blonder. It's, like, neck and neck. But, yeah, so Bob Clark, running a list of his most famous films, you've got Black Christmas, you've got A Christmas Story, and then you've got Porky's and Porky's 2. And, I mean, this is a man who can do it all. And by all, I mean all kinds of shit. Mostly
oh
shit.
My. He also did the infamous Dolly Parton Sylvester Stallone country music film Rhinestone. Yeah, he's wow. he's just got a really interesting career where he started apparently I've not seen it, but he did two movies called A Dead of Night, which was also known as Death Dream, and Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, which are two other horror movies that are apparently very good. I've not seen them, but I've heard they're very good. But then, you know, his last couple credits are Super Babies 2, Super Babies, Baby Geniuses 2, The Karate Dog, and Blonde and Blonder as an uncredited role.
Cheers that God. Is a heck of a thing right there. Bob Clark, man.
Yeah.
He had no shame.
Nope. It's just one of my favorite things to do sometimes, just look at IMDb and look at people on famous movies like Emmanuel Lubezki, who's been Steven Spielberg's director of cinematography ever since Schindler's List. He did Cool as Ice a couple of years before Schindler's List.
Oh, wow.
And
the Vanilla Ice movie?
Yeah, and Dean Cundey, who this kind of ties in a little bit, he was John Carpenter's go-to director of photography for a while, doing things like The Fog, The Thing, and especially Halloween. He went on to be the director of photography for the Adam Sandler film Jack and Jill, and for the Jonas Brothers vehicle Camp Rock.
Well, I guess everybody's got to pay the bills somehow, you know. We all got to eat. Dean Cundey got to eat.
Yeah, they everyone's got to eat, so I can't blame Bob Clark for taking on the Karate Dog, starring Chevy Chase as the voice of the Karate Dog.
One thing about Bob Clark I do know is that the only reason he signed on to direct Porky's 2 was that it was the only way to get funding for A Christmas Story. So people out there who just love A Christmas Story, thank Porky's 2.
Apparently Porky's 2 is a bunch of KKK religious fanatics. I've never seen either Porky's movie, but I mean, you gotta pay the bills, but did not realize A Christmas Story was a passion project for him.
Yeah, like, that was apparently the one he had wanted to make ever since Black Christmas, basically.
Wow. Wow.
But yeah, speaking of Halloween, this movie really is kind of the immediate sort of ancestor of Halloween. Like, a lot of Halloween is very much inspired by and influenced by the look and the design of what Blob Clark, good lord.
Be nice, Joe.
Blob Clark.
That was very mean, and I'm sorry, Bob, if you're up there in the cosmos listening. I apologize. But no, Halloween is owes a very big debt to Black Christmas.
When I was reading, it was intended originally to be a sequel until they just eventually wrote, we just make our own thing.
Yeah. With the thing about Black Christmas is that basically everyone can agree it is one of the earliest slashers. And a lot of horror nerds will say it is the first slasher, but then there are also horror nerds who will say that, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre is the first slasher. But Black Christmas is, like, the earliest movie that everyone can identify as a slasher, and it wasn't as big as Halloween. Halloween was a lot bigger, and Halloween kind of, like, paved the way for the glut of slashers, including, you know, Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street, My Bloody Valentine, things like that. It set the formula, but Black Christmas was a huge influence on Halloween, and you can see exactly the linkage between the two if you watch Black Christmas again.
I mean, like, right even from the very beginning, where you've got that tracking shot, or that POV shot, like, of the sorority house as the killer's kind of stalking the house and looking in the windows and stuff. That is, like, Halloween to the bone.
Oh yeah, like, that struck me on this watch through that it is 100% Halloween stole its opening shot from Black Christmas, And because Halloween only has like the one point of view shot in the very beginning of the movie, but Black Christmas multiple times cuts to Billy. Let's just call him Billy because that's what he's credited as, and that's how he refers to himself in the movie. It cuts to Billy's point of view as he's like doing creepy things like rocking a chair with a dead body in the attic, or just talking to himself or calling people on the phone.
And there are some genuinely disturbing shots in this too. Like Bob Clark really goes for the horror and the shock of some of these scenes. I'm thinking of when the POV shot when Billy is waiting for Mrs. Mack to come up the attic, you know, ladder, and he's got the hook in his hands and he's just waiting for her, and it's just so tense and so spooky and just it really does work as a horror film. It really gets you like antsy.
Yeah, he plays on the dread really well. Like the thing that like really stuck out with me the first time I watched the movie wasn't any of the events, just like those slow pans over the hallways as it like slowly pans and zooms up towards like the attic door where Billy comes in and out to murder, you know, sorority girls. Just the slow pans and zooms on the doors, just it just gets under your skin.
Mm-hmm. And like you could tell they definitely had a visual motif in mind, because they keep cutting to that shot where the camera like looks back up to the attic door, like, remember, he's up in the attic. They don't know it, but you know it.
Yeah, same with Claire in the rocking chair with the bag over her head. Because that's such the iconic shot that was literally the poster for the movie, with the absolutely incredible tagline, "If this film doesn't make your skin crawl, it's on too tight."
God damn, son.
What does that even mean?
I love that tagline. I love the nonsensical taglines, like Phantasm has a great tagline in the same vein, which is, "If this movie doesn't scare you, you're already dead."
One that I've always loved is from Lucio Fulci's Zombie, and it's just plain and simple, "We are going to eat you."
That's a great one. There's also Pieces, which I don't know if you've heard or seen of Pieces. It's a really like trashy low-rent slasher, but it has one of the best endings in horror movie history. But the taglines for it are, "You don't have to go to Texas for a chainsaw massacre." And then the second tagline is, "It's exactly what you think it is." But yeah, I'm a sucker for ridiculous horror movie taglines, and Black Christmas like excels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. John, let me throw it over to you real quick. Had you seen this one before?
I had not. No.
And so you just now, like as we're starting the podcast, like got through with the film. So what did you think of it?
I liked it a lot. I definitely see where a lot of other like horror, it's kind of like watching Die Hard, and then it's just like, oh, this is what every other movie is talking about. Black Christmas is kind of that way for horror movies.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And even even with Black Christmas, you can still see they're taking little bits and pieces of stuff like Psycho and Peeping Tom and other sort of older, more traditional sort of thrillers, and they're turning it into something else. Like this really takes that thriller kind of formula and turns it on its head into what we know of as a slasher movie.
Yeah, and I have to feel sorry for the cameraman who basically used a 1970s camera as a GoPro.
The camera operator for the movie for those POV shots literally like put a rig on him to hold the camera while he was climbing up the trellis on the outside of the sorority house. Just absolutely wild shot that you would never expect to see in a 70s movie, but there it is.
Yeah, like this movie was made, I think, 2 or 3 years before the invention of the Steadicam. So when knowing that, you realize, oh, shit, they just put this camera on his body.
Speaking of did the before, damn thing. This movie had an I Love You, I Know, like 6 years before Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, I forgot. Yeah, I realized that when I was watching it. I was just like, yeah, just it, although in Empire Strikes Back, it feels like a great moment because Han Solo is just like, you know that's what he's going to say. That's what he's expected to say is, "I know," because that's what his character is.
Yeah.
But in Black Christmas, it's just chilling when Olivia Hussey just says, "I know."
Yeah,
after getting into a fight with her boyfriend.
It's like some couples, when they say, "I love you, I know," it's like, oh, that's cute. But then other couples, like, you know, something's going on here. Like,
yeah.
Oh, shit. They're in trouble.
Yeah.
So let's run through our cast of characters real quick here.
Mm-hmm.
So our main girl, our quote unquote final girl, is Jess Bradford. Hey, we do have a Bradford in this episode. Great, I love it. Played by Olivia Hussey, who. A fun story I read about her was that she met Steve Martin at a party of some years after this movie came out, and he came up to her and told her that she started his favorite movie, and she just naturally assumed he was talking about Romeo and Juliet, because most people do. And then he had to correct her and say, no, I've seen Black Christmas 27 times.
Steve Martin's a king.
He's the best. But yeah, Jess is our final girl. She's kind of the not really even the main character. She doesn't emerge as the main character until much later in the film.
Yeah, that's the thing, is it's a real ensemble cast, especially between all the sorority sisters. None of them really get like the spotlight. It's especially with Barb and Jess. Like, it splits the time pretty evenly between them until they start dropping off like flies.
Right. It's never really straight up said like which one is going to be the final girl. They just start picking them off until you realize, oh, we're stuck with this one now.
Yeah.
But then you've got Barb, played by a pre-Superman Margot Kidder.
Oh man, one of the all-time great cinematic drunks.
Yeah. I mean, she's already like kind of, I'm not even sure how to describe her character. She's kind of a lush, but she's also kind of just disturbed a little bit, and she's always making weird sexual jokes at people. And then you get that weird scene where she's just drunk and talking about turtles having sex.
Yeah, just going down to the zoo and watching turtles having sex, but she couldn't watch the whole thing because it takes 3 days. But also, she's not just telling this to just anyone. She's telling this to a dad whose daughter has gone missing.
Yes.
And like, she plays a really thin line between like being just, you know, hilariously drunk, but also saying just some genuinely fucked up shit.
And also, the
comment she makes early on about like the townie girl is just like horrifying.
And also during that entire scene where she's drunk at the dinner, she's just doodling in a Playboy. Like, she has a nudie mag open to the centerfold and is just drawing on it. It's just so baffling.
There's that one exchange where they're like, oh, a townie was raped a couple weeks ago, and she says, oh, you can't rape a townie. Like, oh my god, dude, can you say that? No.
Yeah, she's, like, that's, like, that's the thing. She's a, like, I mean, I guess she kind of is set up as, like, a foil to Jess because, like, Jess is, like, responsible, and Jess is I think, a pretty well-written, like, strong female character. We'll get into that more later, but she's a very well-written character, especially for the 70s. The film is dealing with some very heavy themes, and Margot Kidder, Barb, is just kind of like the opposite of that, where she's, you know, just making horrifically sexist comments.
Mm-hmm. And all I can think is just that, you know, every sorority or every just group of friends has that one friend that the rest of us just can't deal with.
Yeah.
And that's Barb.
Yeah. But again, she's a great character, and the script and the direction do a really good job of balancing her like awful remarks with how funny her drunk shenanigans can be.
I'm feeling a parallel between Jess and Barb, and like I want to say it's Sydney and Tatum maybe from Scream, of just like the friend who's just like the friend of the main character whose character type is, for lack of a better way to put it, drunk whore.
Yeah,
like mm-hmm. I feel bad saying that, but that's literally what they were thinking when they made Scream. It was like, let's just make this character drunk and wants to fuck, and then she dies because she's drunk and wants to fuck, because we're progressive like that, making a horror movie.
My girlfriend and I, like, the same week we watched Black Christmas, we also watched Scream for our like annual Halloween viewing because we love Scream. But there are a lot of parallels between Scream and Black Christmas, specifically like the phone calls, and like you said, the parallel between Jess and Barb is very much, you know, Sydney Tatum. But there is like another aspect to that I think we should get into with our third main character, Peter, played by Keir Dooley. I think that's how you pronounce his name. I don't know how you pronounce his name. Did either of you recognize him? Because I will say, the first time I watched this movie, I did not recognize him at all.
I did not, no. And then looking it up later, I had to go back and look because that can't possibly be right.
That was my exact reaction the second time watching it. I was just like, I just was like, Keir Dooley, that name sounds really familiar. And I looked it up and I was like, no, that can't be him. Did you know who he is?
The name is not ringing a bell. I'm looking at IMDb right now for a picture. Oh, shit. Wow.
Yeah, his IMDb picture is him as Dave Bowman in 2001 A Space Odyssey. He was gotten for this film specifically because of his performance in 2001 A Space Odyssey.
That's kind of amazing, too. And the movie kind of sets him up as being, as potentially maybe or maybe not being the killer. And yeah, they give him plenty of rope to sort of make him, you know, to hang himself, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, because the parallel I wanted to make with Scream is that Peter is a really shitty boyfriend in this movie, where he just takes his girlfriend's issues and he only views them through like, but how does this affect me? Just like Billy Loomis with Sidney and Scream, he's just like, yeah, I know your mom died and she was horrifically murdered, but when can we fuck again? I miss that. and Peter's not on the same level, but like he kind of is very self-absorbed and narcissistic, and Jess is right to tell him off multiple times.
Right. Yeah. So I guess it's at this point I'll point out, if you haven't seen Black Christmas, go give it a watch, because we are going to get into like spoiler stuff. There's not a lot to spoil in this film, but it helps if you've seen the film. So it's streaming on a number of different services, so we definitely recommend you go check it out.
It's kind of funny. It is about as like slow moving in terms of like body count, in terms of like lulls and shit going on and shit not going on, similar to Silent Night, Deadly Night 3, but you don't feel it as much. And I guess it's just testament to how like the quality of the movie.
Fresh for the podcast. Like, I watched this like a week ago, so I wanted to make sure I was fresh for it. I looked up at the plot on Wikipedia for a run through, and there's a lot that happens in this movie. There's not a whole lot of people killed, but there is a lot of moving parts. And I think that's why it's so effective, because it's an hour and 38 minutes, but it fills that to the brim with a lot of different like storylines and plot beats.
And also, like, it's not what you think of as a typical slasher, because it's not just, kill, kill, kill. The majority of the film is structured like kind of like a police procedural, like a mystery, because we know that Claire's been killed, but nobody else knows that Claire's been killed. And so they spend a lot of time talking to the police and organizing search parties and trying to tap phone lines and doing all this other stuff while the killer is still in the house killing people.
Yeah, I explained it to my girlfriend. It's like, it's kind of just like a drama with a body count, because a lot of the major like story elements are just like they're just a regular drama. They're not particularly scary. Like Jess's whole abortion storyline is not really it doesn't really like tie in super well to the horror aspects, but it's just, it's a character conflict that plays out and is exacerbated by the horrifying circumstances they're in.
Right. And like I said, it gives certain other characters, Peter, motive if the film wants us to think that he may or may not be the one killing everybody.
Yeah.
And so it sort of plays dual purposes there. But my favorite part of this film, like away from all of the slasher stuff, all of the killings and everything, is kind of the procedural part of tracking down who it is that's making these phone calls, because all the stuff involving the phone system and the police reminds me a lot of like how methodical, like we'll go back to Die Hard again, but how methodical Die Hard is about setting up all these little threads to then pay off later. Like, I love seeing like the process of how they're doing all of this stuff, mostly because like I didn't know how you would tap a phone call in the 1970s. Now I kind of sort of understand it a little bit better.
It's the tapping scenes are amazing.
Yeah, that's one thing I was thinking about, is I don't think in a modern movie you would have like the two scenes of them failing to like get a trace. Like I think a modern movie would just be like, no, we're not going to waste time with that, even though they don't have anything else. What are you going to put there instead? They'd probably just put more kills in there instead. If they like a straight up remake of this rather than the new remake, which is apparently quite a bit different.
Yeah,
right. And we don't need to talk a lot about the 2006 remake, because we might do an episode on that someday. But also there is a new remake about to come out as we record this.
Yeah, my advice is don't watch the trailer if you don't want to be spoiled, because it looks like the trailer gives away a fuck ton of the movie.
Oh really? Oh man.
Yeah, my girlfriend and I watched it after watching the old Black Christmas, and we're just like, That kind of like gave away, it seems like it gave away the entire movie. Like, I hope there are some like twists and turns in there, but it looks like it gives away like who the killers are and even their motives.
The,
and it just is like,
the 06 remake or the current one coming out?
The current one.
Yeah, I've read like a one sentence blurb, but even that one sentence blurb seems like a spoiler.
Yeah. Which, you know, I'm not super like gung ho about like spoiler policing or whatever.
Oh,
but
yeah, fuck that.
I think it'd be nice to go into a horror movie not knowing quite what's going to happen.
Yeah, like if so, if like the trailer for Shutter Island was like, and it's this fucked up dream this dude has, then it's like, oh, okay.
Oh, spoiler alert for Shutter Island.
Yeah, nobody's going to watch Shutter Island.
I might someday.
Oh, damn. Oh,
but,
we did it.
But Black Christmas. No, that's okay. Yeah, I've known.
But no,
if we can diverge, I could tell you the story how I got spoiled on Shutter Island.
Yeah, sure.
Because I was
just now.
I was hanging out with what?
What just now?
No. Back to when I was in like high school, I was hanging out with some friends, and this guy I was hanging out with, his sister came home, and she was just complaining about how like she was gonna. She was looking at stuff at the Red Box, and she saw Shutter Island, and the guy behind her was just like, oh, is that the movie where he thinks everything's all fake and it's all in his head? And I was like, oh, that spoiled me on that. So you complaining about the spoiler spoiled it.
Also, I remember the trailer for that movie just being like, and this movie has a weird fucked up twist, and that's why you should see it. Like, the movie, the trailer was like, spoiler alert, there is a spoiler.
Goodness,
fucking Martin Scorsese, man, what the fuck?
But I'm thinking about
doing
like
doing?
The old, like, especially on like VHS tapes, the like the plot summary on the back that would give away the entire movie's plot in the summary, and like the basically in like the attract mode was just the entire plot of the movie, pretty much.
Yeah, I still remember my mom and dad's copy, a VHS copy of Total Recall, specifically lays out that he's trapped in a horrifying fantasy world. It basically spells out that, oh yeah, none of the stuff that happens in Total Recall is real, and it's all in Doug Quaid's head.
Oh man, even like getting away from the idea that, oh, you can interpret this one way or the other. Like the back of the box just straight up says, "Look, here's what's going on, dum dums."
Yeah.
Well, that got me to look up the back of the box for Black Christmas. Mm-hmm. From I want to say this looks like it's from, this is like an old DVD from like the dawn of the DVD era. So let's see what they have to say about this. 'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, a creature was stirring. In Bedford, several unsuspecting people are about to receive season's greetings of terror. That doesn't rhyme. Okay, Black Christmas is a stark and stylish horror slash thriller that turns everyone's favorite time of year inside out. Olivia Hussey and Margot Kidder star among an ill-fated house full of sorority sisters celebrating the holiday season. Festivities turn fatal when obscene phone calls break the serenity, and it becomes clear that a psychopath is stalking the house. Predating Halloween and Friday the 13th by several years, Black Christmas effectively laid the groundwork for, okay, blah, 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 everything we literally just said.
Yeah.
Porky's, Murder by Decree, Black Christmas, Bob Clark, Christmas Story. Done.
Yeah. They're kind of wrong about the house of sorority sisters, because, like, the whole point is it's winter break, and a lot of them are, like, picked up already, and they're kind of gone.
Right. I mean, we've got basically four or five.
Yeah.
And then the house mother.
Yeah. And, like, everyone except Olivia Hussey gets got. But, should we do a plot synopsis? Wait, how long are we in? We're, like, almost a half
we're
hour
like half an hour, we're like half an hour in. Usually at this point we're half an hour into the plot synopsis.
Yeah,
so yeah, I guess we can do that.
Yeah,
we basically just did it though. I mean,
yeah,
so
I mean, but there's some finer points, but like they're just for clarification in case there are people who want to listen to this but don't want to watch Black Christmas, which is a mistake because Black Christmas is incredible.
Yeah, I had a coworker recently who I tried to explain to him like that he needed to go see, what movie was it? Oh, Midsommar, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of like asking me how it was or anything like that, he just said, "How does it end? I'm not going to see it." Oh God, like you just tear my heart out.
I was thinking about Midsommar watching this actually, but go ahead.
I was about to say, like, you can't really give away the ending to Midsommar just because it relies on so much that happens before it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've not seen it. Just... I'm vaguely aware of what it's about, but I do remember all of the capital D discourse about it, and people yelling about whether, like, what moral you should take away from the movie and anything like that, of, like, does character X deserve to live or die and dumb shit like that. And it did kind of hit a point where it did have some pushback of people being like, why does this movie have to have a moral? Why can't it just be some fucked up shit what happened? And this movie is definitely just some fucked up shit what happened, Black Christmas.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's fair. I appreciate that. It does not need to be making a fucking moral point about anything. If a movie wants to, that's fine, but movies don't need to.
Mm-hmm.
And I that's probably the biggest crime that fucking Disney has done, is just every movie has to have a fucking, like, stand, basically.
An afternoon school, an after school special.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no character in this that says, you know, won't someone think of the sorority sisters? Like, it just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
My point was more toward, like, I'm trying to get you excited about this movie that I want you to watch, and instead you're just saying, I'm not going to see it. Tell me how it ends. Like, okay, fine. Let's just not have this conversation then.
Yeah.
I hate that stuff. Anyway, yeah. So Black Christmas. trying to get us back on the rails here.
Yeah.
I also read that they specifically didn't have the killer show up as much as they, like, they specifically kept it so ambiguous, just so there'd be absolutely no possible way you could identify or sympathize or empathize or anything with this guy. This dude's just a straight up murderer.
Yeah.
Right. And they even, like, I think they even wrote kind of a backstory for him in case the studio demanded that they use it, and they just didn't use it. But apparently they used that for the remake and incorporated it back into the film.
Yeah, I saw on the Wikipedia page that, yeah, they basically, at the end, they reveal who the killer is, but Clark, Warner Brothers, yeah, asked Clark to change the concluding scene to reveal who the killer is, but Bob Clark was like, nah, fuck that, because it's better the way it is, where just there is no resolution. You thought you got a nice clean resolution, but instead, oops, nothing has changed, and you actually don't know what happened, and that is the really creepy part.
Mm-hmm. The killer is still out there to this day. That's always the better ending, I think. Yeah. Well, not always, but
Billy is still chilling in that attic, waiting for his next victim.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh boy.
No, Black Christmas. So it's So basically, a bunch of sorority sisters get obscene phone calls from a mysterious person who has multiple voices, played by Bob Clark and the director Nick Mancuso, which I don't recognize that name. It sounds familiar, but I just a quick scan of his Wikipedia, I don't see anything I would know him for. But basically, these young women are taunted by a killer, by a person who's just really creepy and fucked up. But one of the girls, Claire, decides to go upstairs to pack for her vacation home, at which point she gets got and strangled to death with a plastic bag, which is, again, the iconic image of the movie, her in a rocking chair with a plastic bag over her head.
Yes. Oh, hang on. Just to pause for a minute. You know what we should have been doing? We did this recently. I should have asked you to see if you can do this in... 60 seconds or less.
Ooh, yeah, I'm down for this challenge. I'm down for this. See if I can get through the rest of the plot in 60 seconds. And I might not make it, because again, there are a lot of moving parts.
All right. So remember, the deal is we will give you 60 seconds to recap the plot of this film. For every second you don't use, we will donate $1 to a local charity. All right. 3, 2, 1, go.
Jess calls her boyfriend Peter. She says, "I want to talk to you." Peter finds out Jess is pregnant, and Jess wants to abort the baby. Peter is like, "Oh no, that's my baby! You're killing my baby!" Jess is like, "Uh-uh, this is my baby. It's my body. I do what I want." And anyway, the house mother also gets got by the killer. Claire's dad shows up to campus and can't find her, and everyone's wandering around trying to find where she went. They go to the police to file a report. The police are like, "Oh, there's also a 13-year-old girl who disappeared." Multiple people gather to search the park to find the little girl. They find the 13-year-old girl, and the lieutenant, played by John Saxon, more on him later, is like, "Hey, you didn't think there were weird calls to the house and two missing girls? You don't think those are connected?" So they tap the phone lines at the sorority house, and while they're tapping the phone lines, the killer calls multiple times, and eventually they realize that the calls are coming from inside the house, but the police officer also overhears that the killer says, the killer on the phone says, "You're killing my baby," which is what Peter said to Jess earlier on. So the police rush to the house and they find Jess is going through the house trying to kill the killer because the killer killed Barb and her other friend Phil, which we didn't cover. So Jess hides in the basement. Peter comes by, busts in a window in the basement, and is like, "Oh, where are you? Why are you down here?" The police show up, and Jess has killed Peter, and Barb and Jess is in bed, and they're like, "Wow, she's gonna take her a while to wake up." But then it cuts to Billy still up in the attic, and the phone rings as the credits roll.
Okay, so I will officially be stealing $23 from a Salvation Army kettle.
Whew. Wow, so even when I tried and I know I got sloppy, it was still way over.
That was a minute 23.
Again, there are a lot of moving parts in this movie.
Yes, this is a very dense 90-some minutes.
Yeah, but there's a lot of really cool scenes. Like, I forgot to even mention that, like, Peter is, like, a musician who, he spent 8 years of his life in the conservatory just trying to be a master pianist, but... when Jess tells him that, you know, she's pregnant with his kid, when she's pregnant, she wants to have an abortion, Peter just, like, goes apeshit and fucks up his piano recital really bad, and then comes up to Jess and says, like, "Hey, Jess, I have an idea. I'm going to quit school so we can get married and have the baby." To which Jess is like, "No.
Not a damn bit." Like, he doesn't even, like, propose. He just comes up to her and says, "Hey, we're getting married."
Yeah, he's like, "I'm quitting. We're gonna get married." And she's just like, "You spent 8 years of your life there. That was your life dream. Ever since you were a kid, was to be a concert pianist. You know, you could give up your dreams. I don't want to give up my dreams."
And then after this fight happens, you know how a lot of slasher movies, a lot of horror movies in general, will just have awful jump scare noises for no reason.
Mm-hmm. Cat scares.
Then this film has Peter smash his piano with a pedestal and just causing the piano to make just awful discordant sounds. And it's jarring and terrible. And the fact that it's just like there's a reason for it in the film and he does it repeatedly over and over. I love that stuff. Love that scene.
Yeah, no, that's a great moment. He just beats the piano because he's just so pissed that he fucked up his recital because, you know, he blames Jess for it. Because, you know, he even says to her in their earlier meeting that, like, you know, you know what this is doing to me? You telling me about this baby and you're having it aborted. You know what this is going to do to me? And she's like, "Yeah, I didn't even want to tell you about it because you were going to act like a big fucking baby."
Yeah. But that's like one of those through lines that makes this film not just another slasher, but it actually kind of gives it some emotion where... another slasher would kind of just... I feel like another slasher would just ignore this completely. Like, you would not find this subplot in any Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Oh, God, no.
No, not a bit. But then, like, every character has that kind of a thing, some kind of a thing going on with them. Like, Jess obviously has the more dramatic one because she's ostensibly the main character. But then, like, we've got the house mother, Mrs. Mack, who is just wonderful. And her little gimmicks is that she constantly keeps grabbing bottles of booze that she's hidden throughout the house.
Mm-hmm.
And just little gags like that. Like she, what's the best one? She pulls a bottle of booze out of like a toilet tank. Fished in there. I love it.
My favorite is her going to the, I think it's the bookshelf, she sees, like, you know, B for bourbon or something like that, and she takes out a book, and she has a hollowed out crevice in the book for, you know, a bottle of sherry.
It's great, too, because, like, all these girls are drunk as hell, and she's just like, "Nope, gotta hide my booze so they can't have it."
I mean, it's sherry, man, it's high quality.
that's the good stuff, yeah. But then speaking of booze, I noticed Barb has a wreath on her bedroom door, and the wreath is covered in little tiny liquor bottles.
Yeah, like it's a film that's full of just great little details like that. Also, another scene that stood out to me that's like a scene you wouldn't get in any other movie is just like the officer being brought into the station with an ass full of buckshot because while searching for Claire, he just went on some guy's property and the guy just unloaded on him with a shotgun.
Yeah.
It just, it doesn't add anything to the story, but it's a really fun scene to include.
Yeah, like, I would say in a lesser movie, you would just feel like, oh, you're just trying to fill time, you know, or wasting time. But in this movie, it more feels like it like, kind of adds it's, to the suspense, because you're just like, no, what the fuck's going on back at the house? Leave this guy alone.
Exactly. But also, it also, like, fleshes this out as, like, something resembling a real community of people.
Mm-hmm.
You get the impression that these are all, like, people living in the same sort of small town. But also, the guy, whoever shot that cop in the ass, which was great, did he not show up later in the film? Or were those two completely unrelated guys with shotguns?
Oh, the guys in the search party who are just going door to door trying to find the killer?
The Canadian guys? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the whole movie was filmed in Canada.
But, like, for the most part, they managed to hide it. These two dudes are just so fucking Canadian. It hurts.
Yeah. Yeah. You hear a couple of boots, but yeah, those two are just so Canadian.
You know, we got to get back on that search party there.
Yeah. You know, just lock all the doors and the windows, eh?
Oh, yeah. Come on, Fred. Let's get going. What we're coming around to is that this is just such a well-produced, like, fully fleshed out little universe that this movie builds for us. And I think that it works to the film's, you know, benefit, because you really believe in the characters and you believe in the setup. And like John said, it makes you nervous, because every minute we're spending out away from the sorority house is a minute that the killer could potentially be doing something terrible.
Yeah. Oh God, can we talk about the cops for a second?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, like, I love the cops in this movie. John Saxon is the police lieutenant. He's best known probably for playing a different police officer. He plays Nancy's dad in A Nightmare on Elm Street and A Nightmare on Elm Street 3 Dream Warriors. But here he's playing Lieutenant Ken Fuller. Originally they wanted Edmund O'Brien for this role, which, you know, I love Edmund O'Brien. He's great in DOA, The Hitchhiker, and The Bigamist. He's, you know, one of the great noir actors, but apparently he showed up to the set and he was in such bad health that they were like, unfortunately, you know, Edmund O'Brien cannot perform the role. But they got John Saxon in last minute, and he does a good job. But my favorite police officer is Sergeant Nash, who is just, can we call him Officer Bumblebutt? Because he is a real bumblebutt.
This is the guy who doesn't know shit, right?
Yeah, he's the guy who is told that when Barb and Claire's dad go to the police to report Claire's disappearance, he asks Barb what the address is, and she tells him it's fellatio, and he just writes down that the address or the phone number or whatever it is fellatio.
Yeah, like instead of like Klondike 5, she's like fellatio 2.
And which pays off much later in the movie when John Saxon just gives him just like laughs him out of turn just because he did not realize what fellatio means.
And it's so great because there's no point to that scene. They're just laughing at him for like 2 straight minutes.
But again, it adds to them being characters, and it makes a fully rounded cast.
Yeah, yeah. And it kind of adds to a feeling of just like, oh God, these girls are fucking doomed. These cops can't figure anything out.
Yeah, like, right. like half the cops are just absolute, like, shit at their jobs, and the only cop, like, John Saxon, to his credit, like, he's the one cop who knows what's going on, and, like, when he's like, we got 2 girls missing, and a sorority house is getting obscene phone calls, and one of the girls that's missing is from that sorority house, you don't think the two are connected?
And there's
leads him to set up the tent.
Exactly, yeah. And there's, like, nothing else going on, so maybe these two things are related. I don't know.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, it's and also, like, another scene that really adds to the community aspect is the search party scene where, you know, they said that a 13-year-old girl never came home from school, like, the week before, so they set up a search party where, you know, everyone who was worried about Claire is in this park trying to find the body of a 13-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm. And I'll go ahead and say that scene was a little bit confusing to me, just because I thought the search party was for Claire.
Yeah.
And then you hear a scream, and then everyone discovers this. You find out later it's the body of a 13-year-old girl. They don't show that because mm-hmm. that would be terrible. But it makes you think, like, oh, did they find Claire? No, they didn't. Claire and Mrs. Mack are still upstairs in the attic.
Oh, God. Mrs. Mack, it's like, she gets the nastiest death scene in the whole movie.
She gets it the worst, yeah.
Yeah, because she goes up in the attic because she hears the house cat. She's about ready to go in a cab to visit her sister, but she hears the house cat, which I can't remember the name of the cat.
Claude.
Claude, thank you. Yeah, she hears Claude up in the attic. So when she goes up to the attic, Billy is up there with like a hook suspended from the ceiling and just throws it at her, and it just sticks her in the throat.
But like the camera cuts over to Billy a couple times, and you just see like these hands holding like the crane hook or whatever it is, and they're visibly trembling. And of all things, it reminded me so much of like some like behind the scenes shit from The Shining, of the scene where he's chopping down the door with an axe, like how he had to basically like psych himself up for it. Like, he basically just, like, just made himself super fucking mad so he could sell the scene, Nicholson did. It reminded me of that. You just see, like, this just, I don't know, just, like, this guy is trying not to scream before he does this, basically.
And the hands are trembling, either because he's trying to psych himself up or because the hook is just so goddamn heavy and he can't hold on to it. Either way, like, it all works.
Yeah, it's fucking incredible. Like, this much acting just to have a fucking pair of hands.
Yeah,
or the scene later on when Jess goes up to investigate Barb's room, where both Barb and Phil are just lying dead on the bed, and she you just see Billy's eye through a crack through the door hinge, and it's just terrifying. It's an eye that does not look like it's a normal eye, but just there's so much acting in just that eye, just showing how unhinged Billy is.
Yeah, from what I read, this was just the cameraman again. It was just like we need someone to look creepy behind there. Ah, cameraman, you do it.
Yeah. Apparently, though, Bob Clark, the director, gets a credit as Billy's shadow. Well, he's uncredited, but yeah, he apparently played Billy in some scenes.
Yeah, like he also did the voice of Billy on the phone calls too, didn't he?
Yeah, he and Nick Mancuso
and a third woman that they just don't identify. I read they don't identify just because they don't remember who the hell did it like that many years ago. This movie's like 45 years old at this point, and they talked about it. Oh, I think
it's one of those productions where I can imagine, like, behind the scenes, everybody did everything. So who's to say?
Yeah, it's just like who's someone who's not acting in this movie yet? We need you to be on the phone call.
Yeah. Right. Also, I do want to point out, I'm pretty sure Claude's name is spelled Clawed.
I am compulsively watch all movies with closed caption, and they did not do that. I don't know if I'm glad or sad that they didn't.
Ugh, I can't have anything. I can't have any fun on this show, John.
We'll pretend. We'll pretend for Joe's sake that it was
the next C-L-A-W-D-E. Cat that the next time I adopt a cat, I am definitely naming it Claude and spelling it that way. Just
the next time you adopt a cat. Do you have a cat now?
I do not know, but when I do.
All right.
No.
All
right. I have to derail this podcast for a while. Joe has a cat.
You could also do a John Pod Van Damme.
Oh.
To be fair, I stole that from Bob's Burgers. That's one of Aunt Gail's cats.
Oh, that's right. That was too good a joke. Oh, boy. So, is there anything else, any stone we haven't overturned yet in this movie? Because, there's a lot of moving parts, lots of missing, a lot of pieces that are falling into place here.
I just want to point out, because Nick said it in those words exactly, the calls are coming from inside the house. The inspiration for this is that dumb-ass urban legend. But they actually make it a point that would actually work in this movie, because the calls are coming from Mrs. Mack's phone, which they establish as a separate phone number, because they're like, oh, we don't need to tap that. It's a separate line.
That's a great bit, because I love the way that scene plays out, because that's, again, our old buddy Sergeant Nash, Officer Bumblebutt, who is told specifically when they realize, you know, when they trace the number, that it's coming from inside the sorority house. The lieutenant just tells him, whatever you do, don't lose your cool. Just tell her to go walk outside and stay outside until the police get there. And then once Sergeant Nash calls Jess and is telling her, you know, you need to go outside, she presses him and he just loses his cool and just yells, the call is coming from in the house.
Wait, what's he gonna do though? Because he's like, do exactly what I say and nothing more. Go outside. Yeah. And she's like, okay, let me go upstairs where the killer is and go look for my friends, and then we'll go outside.
Yeah. Which she still does it anyway. She just grabs the fire poker and starts looking for her friends. who are both dead.
That's just another like scream at the scream moment. She's like, no, dumbass, go the fuck outside. She's like, okay, it's the fucking goon down the well. So I'm going to keep digging, see what happens.
So that leads us into, I guess, the ending of the film, which is, I think it's just like so perfectly constructed, the way they kind of reveal who is and who isn't the killer.
Mm-hmm.
Because so Jess is in the basement with the fire poker, and then Peter like breaks into the basement like a crazy person.
Yeah, like just banging on the window, just yelling, "Jess, are you in there?" And he kicks it open.
Yeah, and then
like he's on a mission.
Right, and then the film basically just cuts away to another scene, and then back, and then Jess has Peter's dead body in her lap, so she obviously killed him.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get that long, protracted scene where she's in the bed after the fact. All the police are sort of filing out of the bedroom, and she's asleep, and everything is like nice and peaceful and quiet. And then the camera turns, and it turns into Barb's room, and you see the bloody mattress. Where Barb was just, like brutally stabbed to death.
Just the mattress. Ugh.
Ugh. And then you go up into the attic and you see the bodies of Claire and Mrs. Mack. You see Claire's like dead face looking out the window as the camera pulls away from the house. And then the phone rings again.
Mm-hmm.
And then you realize, oh shit, it wasn't Peter. Billy's still in the house.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
Do you want to hear about the original ending?
Yeah, yes, I read were two endings, and they decided to do neither of them.
Yeah. The specific ending that I mentioned earlier, Warner Brothers Studios executives asked Clark to change the concluding scene to show Claire's boyfriend, Chris, appear in front of Jess and say, "Agnes, don't tell them what we did," before killing her. Which I think would not have been the best. Again, the reason this ending is so effective is that it offers no answers. It just says, yep, they got it wrong, and Jess is probably dead for it.
Yeah, like, just going off of no information, my first thought was like, it's someone who's obsessed with Claire, you know? But, like, making it her boyfriend just out of nowhere, that sucks. Like, yeah.
Had we met her boyfriend at the beginning of the film? Was he one of those guys?
He's the hockey player.
I don't know. He's present throughout the movie. Like, he's there.
Okay.
Like, they introduce him to the dad because he's trying to find out where Claire is. They introduce him a couple times. I think he also goes to the police station with Barb when she gives.
He's one of the guys who's yelling at them yelling at Nash to stop dicking around, I think. He's the hockey player, like the hockey goalie in that one scene. Mm-hmm.
He's the
hockey
guy. Okay, yeah. So it's not like this is a character that just randomly showed up at the end of the film. Like, he's at least present in the story.
But so if it did turn out that he'd be the killer, that you'd just be like, oh, well, that wasn't established. Cool, thanks, movie.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, there was no reason to think him. Like, the whole movie is, like, it doesn't give many clues to who the killer is. But what few clues it does give leads to Peter being the obvious choice. And then to just have it pulled out from under you that, Jess is dead because they didn't actually catch the killer is the terrifying part.
Yeah, in my mind, what I was going with was like, the killer is just some random psycho who happens to know and is obsessed with Claire. Because like, it seemed like they specifically went in there to murder her, and everything else was just kind of just an improv session pretty much.
But again, there's no answers given. There's no motivation. It just happens.
Mm-hmm. And all of this drama that you thought was so important, film viewer, turns out to not be important at all.
Yeah.
All this drama between Jess and Peter. Nope, not the cause of all of this mayhem and death. Mm-hmm. It's just a side effect, I guess. But that's the end of Black Christmas, and I think it's as good an ending as you could expect from a slasher movie, I think, because especially with one that doesn't have any sequels or any other bullshit attached to it, like, it's just a perfect sort of like spook ending.
I have to say, if the movie did turn out with a twist like, oh, it was really Chris all along, the movie would have pissed me off. Like, I don't know. I don't know where the line is, but having no resolution is better than having a stupid ass twist resolution.
Yeah. Yeah, have you seen Scream 2, J5?
Not all of it, no.
Okay. The thing with Scream 2 is I think it perfectly sums up the idea of having twists just to have twists, where Scream 2 is just really messy. Like, with Scream 2, they... the script leaked online during the film's production, so Kevin Williamson and Wes Craven had to rewrite the entire back half of the movie to change it so it wouldn't be what the spoilers were, and the end result is just a bunch of twists that don't really make sense and just kind of leaves you like, ugh, this was not a good movie, really. And, like, that's the difference, where, you know, this movie, like, took care in order to make sure that the twist ending would actually land. Whereas, you know, if it was just, oh, yeah, if, like, again, the studio executives are the ones who wanted to be Chris. And, you know, they're just like, oh, what ending will get us the most amount of money? And what will be, like, the most satisfying ending, when Bob Clark, the director, is just like, no, I know what will make this a good ending because I'm the director.
Right. The killer is still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just...
Yeah, I guess for me where it falls down is I either want it to have, like, just a fucking, like, just a melodramatic, oh, good guy's win ending, or just something like this where it's just, like, that was fucked up. Like, the dumb, like, Saw-ass shit where it's just like, oh, the killer is just too clever by half. That's the shit that pisses me off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, like, I like the first Saw, but, like, even, like, I saw up to Saw 3, and by that point, just, like... his motivations were just getting extremely convoluted to the point where it was giving you flashbacks to the beginning of a scene that was 10 minutes ago, and the previous 10 minutes have all just been flashbacks, so you forgot the beginning of the scene.
Speaking of Saw, I saw that Cary Elwes is on the cast list for the Black Christmas remake. Is there any, mm-hmm. is there any way he's not the murderer?
Yeah, I mean, again, watch if you see the trailer, they kind of give away who the killers
oh,
are.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and it's like, yeah, like, he might be involved somehow, but, you know, just, like, the way they show it in the trailer, it doesn't seem like he is the killer,
it's just kind of the problem of just, like, oh, what's the one male name I recognize on this list? Oh, he's the murderer.
Yeah.
So, John, we might have to come back around to Black Christmas when this new one comes out.
Yeah, I ain't fucking paying to see anything in the theater, but sure. We can Red Boxing Day it.
Fair enough. So, final thoughts on Black Christmas.
I love it. I think, like, I watched it the first time a couple years ago, and I was like, yeah, that was pretty good. But then when I watched it last week, I was just, like, blown away by it, and just like, holy shit, I forgot. This movie is, like, genuinely really creepy. Like, I don't know if we touch much on the phone calls themselves, but it's just basically, like, it sounds like Billy just speaking in voices as he's making a lot of, like, high-pitched wails and incoherent mumbling about Billy and Agnes, and you can't really, like, you can't tell what he's saying, except in that first phone call especially is just really creepy, where he's just, you know, rambling and just making these high-pitched laughing noises and saying some horrifically derogatory things and really sexist things, like in the vein of the one guy from Silence of the Lambs, and he's just saying these awful things, and then Barb gets on and just yells at him. He just goes, I'm gonna kill you. And that's it. That's the only coherent thing he says. But the rest of the phone calls are just him making high-pitched voices and screeching and laughing. And, ugh, it's a really genuinely upsetting and creepy movie.
Yeah.
But it's really
low
good
on the gore.
Really worth your time.
You see a lot of aftermath, but you don't really see too much, like, you don't see anyone get their damn head chopped off or something like a Jason movie.
Yeah, it's like it's Texas Chainsaw Massacre all over again, where, like, Texas Chainsaw Massacre is really not that violent of a movie, but it just feels really bloody and gross because it's just such a well-made movie, and that's the same thing here, where there's not a whole ton of blood and not really any gore, but it just feels completely just like it's outrageous because it's such a well-made movie that knows when to play its hand and when to hold back.
Yeah, right. I would say
it knows
nothing to be worried about.
It knows when less is more and how to execute, how to deploy its gore and violence. Because, like, even the first phone call, when I heard that, my initial thought was, oh, he's making this phone call while killing somebody. That may or may not be the case, but it gives you that impression and it makes it worse.
Oh, I figured he was just jerking it.
Yeah. Well, that too.
Which, that's Barb's theory, is that he's just, you know... Does someone in this movie say that, like, there are 800 numbers for that? No, that's Scream. Scream is the one where someone tells a Ghostface there are 800 numbers for that. Drew Barrymore, actually, in the beginning.
Wow, there's 800 numbers for that? I thought you had to pay for that stuff.
Maybe it's 900. I don't remember the 90s.
But, whatever, yeah.
I would say, yeah.
10-10-220.
I would definitely recommend this. Is that the one that Carrot Top did the ads for?
That was Dennis Miller.
Oh, Carrot Top was 1-800-CALL-ATT. All right.
Yeah. Sorry.
I would say if you're like squeamish on gore, I would still recommend this because it's not all that gory. Like, you get a couple of gross like reaction shots, but I mean, this isn't like some Rob Zombie bullshit, which God, I hope Rob Zombie doesn't make a Christmas horror movie because I don't want to watch it.
Yeah, that's one of those things. When Bradford disappeared forever, he did leave us a note and said that we need to watch all of the terrible Christmas movies while he's gone.
Yeah, we're going to watch Elf. We already said that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I was, I've been a long time listener, and when I heard that, I had already made the plans to appear on this episode, and I was like, well, Bradford, you done fucked up.
We found our third wheel, Brad. Sorry, bud.
Not in the fact that I'm the third wheel, but like he fucked up you guys watched a good movie without him for once.
No, I'm kidding.
Brad, you're irreplaceable.
We'll talk to you soon, Brad. But so I guess now's the time in the episode where we have to go to the crankometer, which is our ridiculous XY-axis scale for rating Christmas movies. The X-axis is the Christmosity scale, and the Y-axis is the quality scale. So, gentlemen, how Christmassy is Black Christmas? We haven't really even touched on the Christmas stuff in this movie yet.
Yeah, I think it is just such a well-made movie, and there's a lot going on that, like, the Christmas stuff kind of fades into the background, except for Barb's death scene where it cuts to, like, the children's choir outside.
Oh, it's totally
like,
Jaws. It's totally the beginning
screams.
Of Jaws 4, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like, the scenes, two or three scenes of children singing Christmas carols give you that good Christmas feeling, but also those are the scenes where people are getting murdered, so... Yeah.
There's also a good scene where, someone Barb's hanging out with is, like, a drunk Santa, and he's just, like, swearing in front of the kids.
That is my favorite character, just that horrible, like, 70s, like, bushy hair and that shitty mustache he has.
Yeah, just angry Santa just yelling about how bullshit it is that he has to be Santa to these brats.
So you're saying this movie also inspired Bad Santa. Like, is there anything this movie can't do? But and the fact that the setting is over Christmas break, like it's Christmas Eve and then like the two or three days following that, which was a genuine surprise to me. I thought this was going to be, you know, all one night. You know, kill, kill, kill. But then it turned into kind of more of a police procedural, and the drama started to appear, and I was kind of captivated. And I'm talking about quality stuff, but Christmas-wise, there's definitely a good atmosphere around this. There's, you know, the house covered in Christmas lights, and there's snow everywhere. It definitely looks like a Christmas film.
But it doesn't feel like cloying, where it could have been easy to just be like, oh, it's super Christmassy. How fucked is it that we're doing, like, some evil shit on Christmas? Like, it never falls into that trap. Yeah. It kind of feels like the Bradford line about how, you know, one out of every 12 movies takes place in December. But it does have some genuine Christmas atmosphere, but it doesn't go over the top with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good way to get a lot of characters out of the way so we don't just have to, like, stack up a body count or just try to be like, how does nobody notice what the hell's going on?
So I guess on that note, you could make this take place over like the summer break, but it would lose something because, well, what would it lose if you had set this, you know, 6 months later? Really?
It would lose, I think, a lot of the aesthetic of it. I think some of the aesthetic is the Christmas lights and the snow on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, a lot of the plot motivations don't really have anything to do with Christmas.
Yeah, it was originally written not at Christmas, and then they added Christmas in because, like, why not?
Yeah, like, I really think this is one of those original cases where they're taking the setting and then they're sort of twisting it into something darker and spookier. Mm-hmm. Like, so many people and so many movies have done that since that it just feels not tame, but just overused and tired. But this is really one of the first films that does this, I think. Mm-hmm. And certainly there are films before this and several Christmas films after this that do it. But Black Christmas really did kind of set the template for how to do that.
Yeah.
And do it effectively. So I would give this at least a positive 3.
Yeah, I was going to say 2 or 3 positive.
Yeah. Because I think any more and we would be lying to ourselves, but also I think it definitely earns those 2 or 3 points.
Yeah. What does Jane Five say?
The guy who plays Santa looks like it looks like Cotter from Welcome Back, Cotter. That's what I was thinking of. So on that note, I want to give it a 3.
I'll take that as a 3, yeah. All right, so then quality-wise, like I think we're all in agreement. This is a pretty damn good movie.
Yeah, I'm willing to give it a 4 or 5 because it's I really can't think of anything wrong with it, and it is a like it like has echoes throughout film history to our present day where people are still like imitating it, but it's still just as fresh. It's still just as fresh in the year 2019, and it's still just it's still scary as hell.
Yeah, like any kind of like nitpick I would have with a plot or anything like that is basically just summed up by like, most of the police are incompetent at their jobs. So I mean, there's not even like anything I was like, oh, I would change this, that, or the other, you know? Because
yeah, like that's getting into like CinemaSins nitpicking.
Yeah, at the end I was like, why are they just leaving her alone in this house where a bunch of people were murdered? And it's just like, oh, because most of the cops are bad at their jobs. That's why.
Mm-hmm.
It's like incompetent boobs who eat donuts, like prototypical cops. But, yeah, like, I was reading an article, an interview with Bob Clark this morning, and I think it was from 2003, 2004, and he was marveling at the fact that, like, Black Christmas still, like, looks good and still holds up, like, design and aesthetic-wise. Like, even he was kind of amazed at how good of a job he did. Like, wow, I did that really good. But, you know, all of the retro designs are coming back into style, and my movie looks as good as it ever did. But yeah, I'm going to give this a definite 4. I don't have a good excuse as to why I won't give it a full 5. I don't know.
Yeah, I would push for a full 5, but I will definitely be happy with a 4.
I'm going to go with the 5.
I'm outvoted. Okay, so there you have it, folks. Our crankometer score for Black Christmas is a positive 3, positive 5. I'm a little surprised, but honestly, I'm into it.
I'm kind of preemptively giving it a 5 for when we watch the 2006 remake, because I know I'm going to be so fucking mad at that one because of shitty it is compared to this one.
Like, girlfriend told me like the prologue of the remake, and like it sounds more like Rob Zombie's Halloween than Black Christmas, which I like parts of Rob Zombie's Halloween, but it's not the same as Black Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah. Like I read the Wikipedia summary, and first off, the fact that there is a prologue, I was just kind of like, oh fuck, we're doing this.
Yeah, like when the prologue is just all about the killer's backstory, it's just like you're kind of missing what makes the original so good,
right?
Yeah, and especially like Clark even said, like, no, we're going to not have anything about the killer. We don't want you to we don't want you to in any way empathize or like relate to this guy. Nothing at all relatable about him. Whereas, yeah, in the remake, I mean, do we want to, like, kind of spoil it or not?
I mean, go for it. I haven't seen it, but I don't care.
We're not going
like, we're going to watch it, but according to the summary, like, in the remake, yeah, it's about, like, this, it's, like, some, like, fucked up abusive childhood shit turns him into a killer, which is just, like, well, then you have the problem of you have people that had a fucked up abusive childhoods, like, are in, to some degree, sympathetic with him, because, like, yeah, nobody should go through that shit. Not that you should become a murderer from it, but, like, yeah, that dude was in a fucked up situation. Where in this movie, you don't get the chance, because the killer's a force of nature.
Okay, so they literally took, like, that backstory and gave it to Michael Myers, and then like, reverse-engineered it back into the remake of Black Christmas? Is that what they did?
Except Michael Myers in the original Halloween doesn't have an abusive childhood. He's only given an abusive childhood in the Rob Zombie movies, where... You know, the first Rob Zombie Halloween is way more focused on Michael as a character than the original Halloween is.
So I guess then Rob Zombie took that a lot of that from like the original notes for this movie.
Yeah, like it came out Halloween came out the year after the Black Christmas remake.
Okay.
Because yeah, I mean I've not seen the original Halloween, but Michael is just presented as just this creepy ass dude in a mask, right?
Yeah, I mean there is some like in the original, like, the movie opens with him as, like, you know, an 8 or 10 year old boy killing his sister, but you're never given a real reason why, other than just, you know, Donald Pleasance just going, he's evil.
Yeah, like the movie even calls him the Shape. Like, he's not the fully formed Michael Myers. He's just like this unknowable killer sort of character.
He's a force of nature.
Exactly. So yeah, here at Christmas Creeps, we definitely 100% recommend Black Christmas. It's available on a number of streaming services. I personally watched it on Vudu with ads, which once again gave me some really fun juxtapositions when, you know, characters would scream and then it would cut straight to commercial.
I watched it on Tubi, which gave me only one ad with John Cena at the beginning. I did have to I did have to start up incognito mode to watch it, though, because it was not playing nice with uBlock, and I didn't want to turn off uBlock, so I just started up incognito mode.
Fair enough, yeah.
And then at the end, it wanted to autoplay another movie, and that just, like, who the hell is, like, just like, oh, sure, play whatever the hell movie's next. Go ahead.
God. Oh, I just finished Black Christmas. It's time for the Lego movie. Let's do it. But, like, yeah, so you can stream it on Vudu, or Tubi, or Canopy, Shudder, or... whatever the hell Popcorn Flicks is. Man, there's so many fucking streaming sites nowadays. It's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, it's bad.
We're about to pare them all down because the streaming wars are about to kick into high gear.
I'm imagining the streaming wars are going to be like the fast food franchise wars from Demolition Man, where the resolution is just that all of these sites still exist, but they're just all called Netflix now.
Yeah, it's just going to be Netflix, and when you want to watch a TV show, it's just basically nothing but TikToks.
I mean, that's all I do on YouTube anyway, so I'm ready. I'm there. Good Lord. But yeah, so Home for the Holidays is officially over. However, now that we've watched Black Christmas, I'd say one Bob Clark deserves another.
Watching Porky's 2 the next day.
Well, I mean, it's a pretty good prologue, a pretty good preamble for getting into a Christmas story. But yes, this November, we are celebrating Clarksgiving. So come back next time, when we will have another episode of a Bob Clark Christmas thing ready for you. So if you have questions or comments, you can send those to us at xmascreeps@gmail.com or go to Twitter and subscribe there. Follow us on Twitter at Christmas Creeps. Go to iTunes or Apple Music or a podcast or whatever the hell that's called nowadays. Like, comment, and subscribe, all that fun stuff. You know the drill, people. Dr. Nick, where can people find you on the internet? Or do you want them to find you on the internet?
If you want to see me tweet about politics, movies, KMFDM, and various other dorky metal stuff, and Kirby, you can follow me on Twitter at OPencilSharp. That's O-H Pencil Sharp. It's named after a Drive Like Jehu song, and it's not Open Sill Sharp. It's O Pencil Sharp.
I have always wondered that.
Yeah.
Was not brave enough to ask, so thank you for that. So, yeah, that'll do it for Christmas Creeps. I am Joseph Wade.
And I'm Johnny Five, the Human Robot.
And I'm Dr. Nick.
Joe's after that sign-up again.
Billy's after that victim again.
Happy Christmas! Happy Christmas!